Good morning. Today is Thursday, March 9th, 2017. The House Fisheries Committee will come to order at 10:02 a.m. in room 120. Members present are Representative Newman, Representative Fansler, and myself, Chair Stutes. We're also joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Kelsey Goodell from the LIO, and, of course, my committee aide, Reed Harris. We also have with us Representative Eastman. Today we are holding a series of informal presentations on bycatch, and there will be no public testimony. We have a large number of presenters to pack into a two-hour period, so I will ask the committee members to hold their questions until all presenters have finished for the expediency of time. Presenters will be using a PowerPoint presentation, and these documents are currently available online on the state basis system, and we have not printed documents for today's meeting. The order of the presenters are as follows. The National Marine Fisheries Service with Glenn Merrill, North Pacific Fishery Management Council with Chris Oliver and David Witherall, Department of Fish and Game with Commissioner Sam Cotton and Trent Hartle, Groundfish Forum Incorporated with Chris Woodley, United Catcher Boats, Brent Payne, At Sea Processors, Stephanie Madsen, Alaska Groundfish Data Bank, Julie Bonney, and Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association with Linda Binken. So we will begin with Glenn Merrill from the National Fisheries Service. So if Glenn, if you would state your name and your affiliation for the record and begin your presentation, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Glenn Merrill, and I'm the Assistant Regional Administrator with the National Marine Fisheries Service in the Alaska region. And today I'll be providing you a brief overview of bycatch in the federal fisheries, how we manage them, and some of the amounts of bycatch that we have in our various fisheries. First of all, I just wanted to describe for everybody what is bycatch. How do we define this in a federal context? And bycatch is specifically defined for us under the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is the primary law that governs how we manage our federal fisheries. Fish are harvested in a fishery but are not sold or kept for personal use are bycatch. And this includes two categories, economic discards and regulatory discards. First of all, I think it's important for the committee to understand that bycatch does occur in all fisheries, regardless of gear type, the area fish, or the time of harvest, whether it's in sport fisheries or in the large commercial fisheries that occur in federal waters. However, the amount and type of bycatch varies. That will depend upon the type of gear that's used. It will depend upon the fishery that's being prosecuted at that specific time. Seasons also affect the amount of bycatch. There are two main categories of bycatch. There's economic discards, as I mentioned earlier. This is when fish are too small, there's no market for that specific fish or for other reasons. Overall, this is a relatively small proportion of the total amount of bycatch that we have in our fisheries. Most of our bycatch are due to regulatory discards. That means that we have specific regulations that require that the fish are discarded. We often do that in order to ensure that there's adequate harvest for other fishermen who are active in specific fisheries. For example, trawl gear is a prohibited gear for harvesting halibut. You have to discard all of your halibut if you're using trawl gear. We also have specific seasons that are established in order to make sure that we are not targeting fisheries when they are in spawning aggregations or at other specific times of year where they may have specific impacts on the stocks. We also have...
Sorry for one moment, sure. While I recognize Representative Chenault, whose phone is buzzing at this moment. Good point. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Or due to other regulations. Anytime from a federal context when we consider how we want to manage bycatch, there are really two main factors that we consider. We consider the benefits and costs of any management measure on fishermen, and we consider the impacts on the stocks. Reducing bycatch can certainly increase the harvest for some fishermen and reduce stock impacts. However, it's almost always a trade-off. If you are reducing the bycatch in one fishery, that often means that you are also reducing or limiting harvests in another fishery. Oftentimes, we also have to consider what the cost of reducing bycatch on one fishery will be in terms of the overall ability to improve a stock. We might be able to reduce bycatch, but it may not necessarily result in a substantial improvement in the stock overall. The Magnuson-Stevens Act specifically requires that when we consider any bycatch management, we have to balance a range of factors. And I've listed for you here four national standards of the 10 that we have to consider any time we adopt a federal action. For this committee, I think a particular interest is a requirement under the Magnuson-Stevens Act that we minimize bycatch and bycatch mortality to the extent practicable. But we also have to balance that with achieving the optimum yield from each fishery, fair and equitable allocation among various fishermen, the sustained participation of communities, and several other factors as well. The main types of bycatch that occur in our federal fisheries are groundfish bycatch, and this is basically the catch of anything except for halibut, salmon, herring, and some shellfish. Halibut bycatch and salmon bycatch, and Chinook salmon bycatch in particular. I'll briefly focus on the groundfish bycatch, but spend most of my presentation talking about halibut bycatch and salmon bycatch. For groundfish bycatch, in other words, these are fish that are discarded at sea in our various fisheries. Overall, a very large proportion of all the fish that are harvested are kept and delivered for processing or processed on board vessels. And I have here for you a table that just briefly describes, it gives you the scope and the size of the various fisheries that are harvested by gear type and the proportion that is retained for each of the gear types. So for trawl fisheries, which make up the vast majority of the total amount of harvest that occur in federal waters, roughly 2 million pounds are harvested on an annual basis, and 98% of that is retained. Much of what is discarded are pollock or arrowtooth flounder, a number of species for which there are not necessarily markets, such as skates, sculpins, and some rockfish species. For hook and line gear, it's a smaller proportion of total harvest, about 150,000 metric tons, and roughly 81% of this is retained. Most of the discards in that are Pacific cod, and then there's a number of other species that you can see as well. And then we have a much smaller proportion of federal fisheries that are harvested using pot gear, about 50,000 metric tons. And again, about 96% of that is retained. So overall, in terms of bycatch of groundfish, there's a very small proportion that is discarded on an annual basis. For halibut, I have before you a table that shows halibut bycatch in our groundfish fisheries from 2003 to 2016. I think the important point to note here is that bycatch of halibut in our groundfish fisheries is at an all-time low in 2016, slightly less than 4,000 metric tons. And that's due to a wide range of management actions that have been undertaken by us and the North Pacific Fishery Management Council over the last couple of decades, as well as initiatives that the industry has undertaken as well. You'll be hearing about those more from other presenters. As you can see from this table, it also shows the amounts of bycatch for the various types of gear that are deployed in federal fisheries off of Alaska. And there's overall been a decrease for all gear types most recently in the last 3 or 4 years.
I'd like to recognize Representative Christ Tompkins, please. Thank you.
Another way to look at bycatch is also to look at what proportion of total catch in a fishery is due to bycatch. And this pie chart shows you that for halibut bycatch, it represents roughly 17% of all of the removals that are occurring in the fishery. And this is the bycatch in the groundfish fishery. 60% is due to commercial landings. So, of course, the actual commercial harvest is the largest proportion of the total catch that occurs of halibut. 17% is sport fisheries, and that includes charter and unguided sport fisheries. The 3% that you see in red there for personal use and subsistence includes personal use in Canada as well as the United States here in Alaska. And then 3% for commercial wastage, which is sort of a what you might call bycatch in the commercial fishery. For salmon, and Chinook salmon in particular, this has been of great interest to the council and numerous constituents throughout Alaska over the years. We are interested in two things. One, we're interested in the total amount of Chinook salmon bycatch that occurs, but we're also interested in understanding where that Chinook salmon bycatch is coming from. Chinook salmon mingle quite a bit within the ocean. And so one of the things that we undertake on an annual basis is a review of the genetic composition of bycatch that occurs in our various fisheries. The map that you have before you shows the specific areas where we define different stocks, different genetic compositions of stocks that we use to then determine how much of a specific amount of or area of Chinook salmon is being taken in our fisheries. The graph that you have here shows two things. It shows the total amount of Chinook salmon bycatch that's occurring in our Gulf of Alaska fisheries. For all of our fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska, we have limits that are established on an annual basis that curtail the maximum amount of Chinook salmon that can be taken. Overall, and you can see from this, we've had some reductions substantially in the last few years in the amount of Chinook salmon bycatch that's occurred. That's due to a number of management measures that we've undertaken, as well as fleet efforts to try and reduce their bycatch. The pie chart that you see there describes the areas of Chinook salmon bycatch that are coming from our pollock fishery, which is contributes to the largest proportion of the total amount of Chinook salmon bycatch. And roughly 6% is bound for what we are calling other areas. Another way to look at this is to look at this in terms of what proportion of the Chinook salmon bycatch is coming from areas of particular concern in the Gulf of Alaska. And roughly 5% of the total bycatch is coming from Kodiak and Cook Inlet rivers. Nearly 80% of all the bycatch is occurring from Canada or the lower 48, or also from Southeast Alaska as well, where there's substantial hatchery production. So overall, a very small proportion of the Chinook salmon bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska is bound for these particular river systems. For the Bering Sea, the story is a little bit different, as you might imagine, because there's a different composition, different areas where the Chinook salmon are harvested. What you can see here from this graph is a reduction in Chinook salmon bycatch overall since the early mid-2000s until recently. I also have included a pie chart similar to the last one for the Gulf of Alaska that describes the genetic composition of the amount of Chinook salmon bycatch in our pollock fishery. As with the Gulf of Alaska, there are limits that are established on an annual basis for how much Chinook salmon can be taken. We are well below those limits, and roughly 44% of all of the Chinook salmon that's taken is bound for what we call coastal western Alaska and the Yukon River systems. Another way to look at this is to look at this in terms of what proportion of the total returns that are coming to western Alaska and Yukon rivers is being taken as bycatch in the fisheries in the Bering Sea. And for Chinook salmon, less than 3% of the total returns to western Alaska rivers are due to bycatch. For chum salmon, which is also something of concern for the council and for the National Marine Fisheries Service, less than 1% of the total returns are bound for western Alaska rivers.
Thank you, and I'd like to recognize Representative Tarr.
So how do we control halibut and salmon bycatch now? We have a wide range of regulatory measures that we've undertaken, as well as non-regulatory measures. From the regulatory standpoint, one of the tools that we often use are bycatch caps. These are specific limits. These have been established for the halibut fishery and for the Chinook salmon fisheries as well. These limit the amount of salmon that can be taken, and we will close fisheries, ground fish fisheries, if those caps are reached. Another way that we manage bycatch is through closure areas to limit harvests in specific areas. Those are not typically used that often for our halibut fisheries. There are some specific provisions in place for the Bering Sea for some of our salmon fisheries. We also have limits on the specific use of gear in some fisheries, so we don't allow specific gear types to be used, or we require certain modifications to be made to gear so that it reduces the impact, say, on halibut fisheries. One of the tools that we've used quite substantially in the North Pacific arc is catch share management. And that is the allocation of quota to fishermen that will allow them to avoid a race for fish. By having an annual allocation, they're able to tailor their fishing operations to what they are able to harvest. That allows them to slow their fishing down. By slowing their fishing down, they're able to communicate with other participants and adopt better fishing practices, whether that's through implementing halibut excluders on board their vessels, improving the communication with other members of the fleet, and a range of other actions that they can undertake that is difficult to do or impossible to do if you don't have some form of coordinated management. We've also, in the Bering Sea, linked Chinook salmon bycatch caps to Western Alaskan returns so that those Chinook salmon bycatch caps will be reduced during specific periods of low abundance within the river systems of Western Alaska and the Yukon. We have an experimental fishing permit program that we have been using over the last several years that allow vessels in the Bering Sea to undertake what we call deck sorting. Trawl vessels will accidentally catch halibut when that halibut is brought on board. If it can be returned to sea within a short period of time, within 20 or 30 minutes, the survival of that halibut is much greater. Because that survival of that halibut is much greater, we're very interested in trying to allow vessels to undertake this deck sorting activity so that when they do catch halibut, it has a much lower mortality rate. Making sure that we do that in a way that we also get proper accounting of halibut is a little bit of a trick. So we've been working with the fleet through an experimental fishing permit program to undertake those kinds of operations. We also constantly communicate with the fleet. We're telling them where we're seeing areas of high bycatch. We're telling them what the rates are on a regular basis. They're constantly communicating with us as well. And this has been very useful in trying to identify specific hot spots or when rates are particularly bad in specific fisheries. And, of course, the industry is very involved in bycatch management as well. Bycatch is costly for them. As I mentioned earlier, if you have a bycatch cap that closes the fishery, you want to avoid bycatch. So they undertake a variety of different measures, whether that's voluntary cooperatives. They use special gear types, as I've mentioned earlier, excluder devices that can be used to avoid halibut and salmon, and stand downs during periods of high abundance. What will we be doing in the future? One of the things that we're looking at through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is trying to link halibut bycatch caps to the abundance of halibut so that it will vary with the abundance, and therefore there will be lower bycatch caps if there's lower amount of halibut and possibly higher bycatch caps if there's higher amounts. As I mentioned earlier, we have an experimental fishing permit program to allow deck sorting. We're looking at implementing regulations so that vessels would have specific guidance on how to implement that beyond just an experimental fishing permit, and that would be for all waters off of Alaska, both the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. We're constantly looking for ways to improve communication with the fleets. We're encouraging more industry efforts as well. And we are also interested in facilitating catch-share programs when supported by the council. So should the council choose to undertake additional catch-share programs in the future, and we find some particular advantages to that in terms of bycatch reduction, we will continue to support those efforts. And, of course, we are constantly reviewing performance. Throughout all of our bycatch programs, we have annual reports that the fleet provide to us. We provide annual reports back to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. There is a constant ebb and flow of information back and forth about the types of bycatch that we're observing in our various fisheries. And then with that, Madam Chair, I just have a list of where you and the other members of the committee may want to go for additional information for contacts.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. We certainly appreciate your presentation, and I'm going to take a brief at ease so we can set up for the next presenter. And I would like to remind the presenters we have in the area of about 10 to 12 minutes because we have quite a few that we want to hear from. And I would like to remind the committee members, if for some reason we run out of time in relation to questions, please write them down. Excuse me. I will get them to the appropriate individual, and we will get answers for all of the committee. Thank you. With that, we will move on to Chris Oliver and David Witherell from North Pacific Fishery Management Council.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and committee members. I assume you can hear me.
We can hear you loud and clear almost. If you could just turn your volume up a tad, or maybe we can.
Okay. Thank you.
Perfect.
I'm just going to provide a 30,000-foot view of the North Pacific Council process and some of our recent major actions related to halibut and salmon bycatch. Mr. Merrill already mentioned the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is our overarching law for managing fisheries in federal waters around the country. It established our 200-mile economic zone, as well as the system of state regional councils that essentially we developed the fishery management plans and regulations for federal fisheries. Those are subject to approval and implementation.
Okay, excuse me for one moment. I need you to identify yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
I'm sorry, Chris Oliver, Executive Director of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver.
And as I was saying, the council essentially developed the plans and regulations. Those that are approved and implemented, monitoring and enforcement as well by the National Marine Fisheries Service. Going to the next slide, that's titled Magnuson-Stevens Act National Standards. Mr. Merrill mentioned these. I want to highlight two of them because they're very important in the bycatch discussion context. First is prevent overfishing, but that's an abbreviated bullet. What it actually says is prevent overfishing while achieving optimum yield from the fishery. And, you know, we harvest on the order of 2 to 3 million metric tons of groundfish per year. And National Standard 9 is minimize bycatch and bycatch mortality. And there's a constant tension between those two national standards and a balancing act that we're continuously engaged in to attempt to get the most out of our groundfish fisheries, both trawl and hook and line, at the same time attempting to minimize to the extent practicable bycatch, particularly salmon and halibut, obviously are important bycatch species. The next slide, please, is the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. It's just a subscription of our structure. We have 11 voting members, 6 of whom are from Alaska, including the Commissioner of Fish and Game. We meet 5 times a year, sometimes 6. We have our industry advisory panels, our science committee, and numerous other committees that provide advice to the council on various issues. It's somewhat similar to the Board of Fish process, but very different in some fundamental ways. The next slide is simply a roster and pictures of our current council membership, and I'll skip on to the next slide. The title, Who Manages What Fisheries Off Alaska? Obviously, salmon is primarily state managed. With regard to crab, we have a crab fishery management plan that essentially defers much of the management to the state of Alaska. Our primary focus is on groundfish in conjunction with the National Marine Fisheries Service. And then halibut is a species that's managed all the way to the coast through treaty international treaty between the U.S. and Canada, with the International Pacific Halibut Commission primarily responsible for the fundamental conservation and management setting quotas, and then the council involved in the policy and allocation of halibut, including setting bycatch limits for halibut. And I'll go to the next slide, which is important elements of the ecosystem-based approach. There are a number of things that we include in what we believe is an overall ecosystem approach. Most critical to that are conservative and strict catch limits and bycatch limits. And those are limits on both directed, you know, groundfish species as well as limits on the amount of halibut and salmon that can be taken in the prosecution of those fisheries. An important component of that is a comprehensive observer program. Comprehensive groundfish observer program. And the next slide, actually the next 2 slides, provide some detail on that. I won't go into that in great detail. Essentially, in most of the Bering Sea fisheries, large vessels, high volume fisheries, there's at least 100% observer coverage. That's implemented at a cost of $15 or more million a year to the industry itself. We also have a fee program. Going to the next slide, that covers our what we call our partial coverage vessels, and a lot of the vessels in the Gulf of Alaska fall under this program, smaller vessels, and less overall observer coverage in those fisheries. But we are also, importantly, implementing electronic monitoring camera alternatives, particularly for smaller longline and pot vessels. A lot of detail I could go into on the observer program, but I'll go to the next slide, which is titled Bycatch Controls for Prohibited Species. And this is our fundamental key important aspect of bycatch management that I mentioned earlier, and that's simply bycatch caps. We have limits on the amount of prohibited species catch that can be taken in these various fisheries for salmon and for halibut. There are also a number of industry efforts that Glenn mentioned and that you'll hear more about to reduce bycatch through a variety of means, including gear modifications and intercooperative agreements and those sorts of things. But going to the next slide, which is specifically about Bering Sea salmon bycatch, there is a overall 60,000 Chinook salmon bycatch limit. There's sort of a complicated incentive plan that to remain below 47,000 fish, and a number of other aspects of that. Key component, I just want to be clear, is there are caps in place on this, and we've recently, going to the next slide, recently made modifications in April of 2015 to more stringent incentive plan requirements. We require salmon excluder devices. We've established a lower bycatch caps in years of low Chinook abundance, and there's an index that we use to monitor whether those lower caps kick into place. And I'll go to the next slide, some additional provisions of that program. 100% observer coverage on the fisheries that are predominantly taking bycatch of Chinook. We have a census of all salmon by observers, increased genetic sampling so that we can have a better handle on where these fish are coming from, their stocks of origin. We have annual reports, including coming up in April, on this genetic stock of origin results. And we also have annual reports that are also coming up in April on the effectiveness of the industry incentive programs, including a third-party audit on those. Going to the next slide in the Gulf of Alaska, and I'm going rather quickly, Madam Chair, in the interest of time. I know there will hopefully be time.
We appreciate it, and these slides are all available to all of the committee members or anybody on basis.
The Gulf of Alaska pollock fishery, we have a 25,000 Chinook salmon bycatch limit, and that's a portion between the central and western regulatory areas in the Gulf. And then we have a separate 7,500 Chinook salmon bycatch limit for the non-pollock trawl fisheries. Going to the next slide is discussing Gulf halibut PFC limits. And we took action in June of 2012 to reduce the existing halibut PFC limits in the trawl and catch vessel longline sectors were decreased by 15%. And in the catcher processor sector, we decreased them by 7%. And so you can see where the current limits now stand, which are 266 metric tons for hook and line and 1,706 for trawl gear. And that's a portion seasonally and among some of the deep water and shallow water species trawl fisheries. In the Bering Sea, going to the next slide, Bering Sea halibut bycatch measures, in June of 15, the Council took a pretty significant action in the Bering Sea by reducing the halibut bycatch limits across the board by overall 21%. And you can see how that's broken down in the slide between the different sectors. I guess the message there is we've long had bycatch caps in place, and we took a fairly significant step in June of 2015 to reduce those bycatch limits by a total of 21%. And as you'll hear in a little while from some of the industry groups, they've actually managed to largely come in below those numbers through a variety of efforts that they have in place on the water, and that'll come up in some of your industry reports. Going to the next slide, additional items related to Bering Sea halibut. We've established an overarching framework with the Council to improve our coordination with the International Pacific Halibut Commission. With them, we are in the process of exploring a different way to apply our caps to base them on overall abundance that could float up or float down with overall halibut abundance rather than a fixed cap. We have annual reports from the trawl fisheries, particularly the Amendment 80 sector, requirements to achieve reduced halibut bycatch and the measures they're developing within their fleet and their cooperative arrangements to not only stay not only within the cap, but hopefully under the caps that we have in place. We're looking, Glenn mentioned deck sorting. There are a number of efforts underway to allow halibut to get returned to the water quicker and hopefully reduce the overall mortality that's associated with these fisheries. And really, the last slide I have is essentially a summary slide of idle PSC bycatch limits, and it just breaks down the different halibut, the different bycatch species, halibut and Chinook salmon, but also herring and crab, and how those caps are distributed across the different gear types, and where the limits are and what the actual catch was in 2016. And you can see, for example, in the Bering Sea trawl fisheries, with regard to halibut, the actual catch came in well under the cap. Similarly in the other fisheries, and similarly with regard to Chinook salmon. So that was sort of a summary slide to give you an overall picture of where our limits are and where the actual catch has been occurring lately. And I'll stop at that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. We certainly appreciate your presentation. With that, we'll take a brief at ease to set up for our next presenter, which will be the Department of Fish and Game with Commissioner Cotton and Trent Bartle. Chris Tompkins had a very, very brief comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to pass on to the former presenter, fingers crossed that maybe he might find himself in a position in D.C. as the NIMS director in the new administration.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Thank you. Okay, if you'd state your name and affiliation for the record, please, and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sam Cotton, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm joined today with by Trent Hartel, who is a fisheries biologist with the department, who is also our acting federal fisheries coordinator and serves as my alternate on the North Pacific Council. And he'll be making he'll have a slide presentation here to show some of the bycatch issues in state water fisheries. And I just have a few comments I'll make before that. I thought the National Marine Fisheries Service representative Glenn Merrill did an outstanding job of going through the programs that the United States government operates, and Chris Oliver from the Council went through a lot of information that normally would take about a couple of weeks to explain in great detail, so I thought he captured it very well. One quick note on definition of bycatch, and Glenn went through that a little bit, but sometimes it gets confused with incidental catch. And we see that, for example, just recently there was some notes about sockeye being taken in Kodiak that were bound for Cook Inlet, and those are referred to as incidental catch. They're perfectly legal. They've been going on for a long time. Same things happened in out west in Area M fishery, often referred to as a false pass fishery, where interception of chum salmon bound for western Alaska is often referred to as bycatch, but it's really incidental catch. However, the Fish Board has taken measures to restrict take. For example, there's been chum caps. There are certain areas that there are limits on how many red salmon can be taken because they might be bound for another location. So the Fish Board has that ability to restrict incidental catch, even though it's not bycatch. The state participates on the council, and that's been mentioned. We have 6 of the 11 votes on the council. The council typically tries to find a fair balance between harvesters supplying food for the nation and the needs of the directed halibut fishermen and the people who are dependent on salmon resources in Alaska. Alaska members in particular are especially aware of the concerns of residents dependent upon halibut and salmon, while council members from other areas will more often hear from industry representatives who are concerned about constraints on their ability to harvest the tack or the total allowable catch. Many Alaska communities also have a large dependence on ground fish, like Kodiak, Sandpoint, King Cove, and many other parts of Alaska, and we also hear from them on a regular basis. Proportionally, approximately 86% of the ground fish harvested is taken by people who identify themselves as other than Alaska residents. This is skewed somewhat by the fact that the bulk of the catch is pollock, Bering Sea pollock, and when you look at the Gulf of Alaska, there's a much higher participation by people who actually live in Alaska. The other point made was the proportion of fish in the Gulf of Alaska, referring to Chinook salmon, that are Alaska fish. It's about 20%. The bulk of those are from southeast Alaska. So, for example, we will, now that we're going to impose some new restrictions on Chinook harvest in southeast Alaska, we're likely to hear from people in this area that will ask about bycatch and how it affects their fishery. In fact, a lot of the fish from southeast Alaska are hatchery fish, but they're still important to a lot of people in this part of the world. It wasn't until just recently that any Chinook limits were in place, either in the Gulf of Alaska or the Bering Sea. I think in the early 2000s, there was a big spike in the Bering Sea Chinook harvest. I think about 120,000 fish were taken 1 year, and soon after that, the council established actual limits. And you can look at these. That's the thing about the fishing industry. There's a lot of data, a lot of statistics you can use, and Mr. Merrill pointed out that only 3% of the fish that are harvested, or the Chinook salmon that are taken as bycatch in the Bering Sea, represent only about 3% of the fish that would have entered the rivers. But on the other side of that, about in the neighborhood of 50% of the Chinook salmon taken in the Bering Sea are Alaska-bound fish. So there's just a couple different ways to look at that. I'll stop there and look forward to any questions you might have, and then ask Trent to walk through just a couple slides we have here that describe bycatch in relation to Alaska fisheries.
Thank you.
State fisheries.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the previous couple presenters have done a good job of describing some of the bycatch management measures and the fisheries in federal fisheries. So I'm going to take a couple slides to briefly orient you to salmon and halibut bycatch that can occur in state-managed fisheries.
Mr. Hartle, would you identify yourself on the record,
Trent Hartle,
please?
Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you.
So if you recall back to our presentation to this committee maybe a month ago or so, there's two types of fisheries that occur in state waters. There's guideline harvest level fisheries and parallel fisheries. Guideline harvest level fisheries, or GHL fisheries, are managed directly by the Department of Fish and Game. Regulations are promulgated through the Alaska Board of Fisheries. And in these fisheries, we don't typically have salmon or halibut bycatch limits. The exception is the Prince William Sound pollock fishery, and I'll get to that at a later slide. One of the reasons that these fisheries don't have bycatch limits is that the state does not administer a groundfish observer program. An observer program is a key element in being able to track, enumerate, and estimate total bycatch in fisheries. Another aspect of these GHL fisheries is that they tend to be small in scope. The total catch limits are smaller compared to federal fisheries, and the overall effort in them tends to be much smaller compared to federal fisheries. A couple of measures that the state, particularly the Alaska Board of Fisheries, has taken to assist in reducing bycatch. Generally, the state prohibits non-pelagic trawl gear in most state waters. There are areas of the state that are open to non-pelagic trawl gear. I'll show that in a subsequent slide. And in addition, the state generally has limited directed GHL longline and trawl fisheries. Some do occur, and I'll go over that in a following slide. Conversely, parallel fisheries are essentially a federal fishery that occurs inside state waters. The total allowable catch or the harvest limit is established by the council and implemented by National Marine Fisheries Service, and to assist in providing a seamless transition between fisheries between different jurisdictions, the state of Alaska and federal waters, the state generally adopts all the applicable regulations and rules of the federal fishery into state waters. As such, the salmon and halibut bycatch that occurs inside state waters is accounted for and deducted from the federal bycatch limits. Additionally, any of the vessels that participate in these parallel fisheries are subject to the federal observer program requirements. And the last bullet points here is despite the parallel fishery being a wholly state-managed fishery, the Alaska Board of Fisheries has jurisdiction to modify regulations in the parallel fishery. The management structure for those fisheries are largely determined at the council level and implemented by NIMS. And Mr. Oliver and Mr. Merrill did a great job of describing a number of the programs that are being implemented or being worked on to assist in reducing or mitigating bycatch in these fisheries. And one element of this is that, as was mentioned, the state of Alaska, the commissioner has a seat on the council, and recently the state forwarded a motion to allow a reapportionment of Chinook salmon bycatch limits between fisheries. So if a bycatch limit is reached or approaching being hit, there's added flexibility to allow different bycatch limits to flow between each other. So quickly, I'll go through the guideline harvest level and the sable fish quota fisheries that occur in the state. In the southeast area, there's a variety of longline GHL fisheries. There's the demersal shelf rockfish, commonly referred to as DSR. There's directed longline Pacific cod and sable fish fisheries. As you can see, the catch limits for these fisheries are lower compared to federal fisheries. They range as low as 170,000 for DSR, up to around a million for Pacific cod and sable fish. One common theme that you'll hear me discuss in for the following areas is that despite there not being any bycatch limits in these fisheries, many of the participants also hold halibut IFQ. One provision of that is if they have available IFQ unused and they're participating in the appropriate regulatory area, discard of halibut is not allowed. So the potential for discarded halibut, dead halibut being returned to the water, is to some degree mitigated by the fact that we have vessels and participants that have a portfolio of fisheries that they participate in, and a lot of that halibut bycatch is retained and delivered as halibut IFQ. Southeast area, the Board of Fisheries has also prohibited trawl gear in this area. Prince William Sound, it also has a couple longline fisheries, sable fish fishery and the Pacific cod fishery. There's no bycatch limits, but again, the overlap between IFQ holders, halibut IFQ holders, and participation in state waters fisheries is broad. It varies year to year, and it's unique between fisheries, but in some fisheries it ranges up to 100%, and some between 50 to 80%. I did mention that the Prince William Sound pollock fishery is somewhat unique for GHL fisheries. It's the only GHL pollock fishery in the state. For 2017, the total allowable catch or the harvest limit is just over 9 million pounds. And there is a salmon bycatch limit set for that fishery. And for 2017, it's just under 4,000 pounds of salmon. In the Cook Inlet area, there's one longline fishery. It's just under 50,000 pounds, and just about 100% of those participants also hold halibut IFQ. And additionally, the Board of Fisheries has prohibited use of non-pelagic trawl gear in that area. So for the state managed parallel fisheries, in the Kodiak area, there's parallel longline Pacific cod and trawl pollock in the Kodiak area. Any bycatch that occurs in those fisheries inside state waters accrues to the federal bycatch limits, and all state waters in the Kodiak area are the Board of Fisheries has prohibited use of non-pelagic trawl gear. In the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands, the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands fisheries are much larger, more complex, there's more species, but some of the management structures in the parallel fisheries are similar. We have parallel longline for Pacific cod, parallel pollock, Pacific cod, and Atka mackerel, and many of the state waters in the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands are closed to non-pelagic trawl gear, particularly along the coast of western Alaska, and then there's a variety of areas within the Aleutian Islands that are open to non-pelagic trawl gear, and there is participation in those areas. For the South Alaska Peninsula area, there's a couple. There's a longline Pacific cod parallel fishery and trawl pollockin Pacific cod. There are a variety of areas within state waters that are open to non-pelagic trawl gear. These typically have been identified by stakeholders as being historically important and common fishing grounds, and so the board has retained those areas, allowed them to remain open and continue to the locals to local fleets to fish there. Finally, the Chignik area, it similar to some of the other areas, has longline Pacific cod and trawl and parallel pollock fisheries, and all of those state waters are close to non-pelagic trawl gear.
Mr. Hartel, just for benefit of this committee, could you give a very brief explanation of what non-pelagic trawl gear is?
It's bottom trawl gear. It's a trawl net that has some proportion of time spent on the bottom.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a little bit more on that. Typically, the non-pelagic trawl fisheries are going after cod or other bottom fish like yellowfin sole or arrowtooth flounder, whereas the pelagic gear refers to midwater where you're going to find pollock.
Thank you. Continue.
That concludes my presentation.
Beautiful. You guys have done a great job staying within the time frame. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate the time you've taken, and we will take a brief at ease. And next we will... Chris Woodley, if you would state your name and affiliation for the record, please, and go forward with your presentation.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Special Committee on Fisheries. My name is Chris Woodley, and I'm the Executive Director of Groundfish Forum. Thanks for the opportunity to discuss how our fleet has been addressing the issue of halibut bycatch in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands. We're in a little bit of a... I need to click the right button here. A little bit of a who's who in the zoo right now, so you're just going to take 1 minute to tell you about our fleet. So Groundfish Forum is a trade association representing five companies who operate 19 trawl catcher processor vessels. Our fleet is collectively known as the Amendment 80 Sector. This fleet of U.S. flag vessels catch, process, and freeze various flatfish, aca mackerel, Pacific Ocean perch, and Pacific cod in the federally managed fisheries of the Bering Sea, Aleutian Islands, and Gulf of Alaska. In carrying out these fisheries, the Amendment 80 sector makes over 550 port calls a year to Alaskan communities where we deliver processed catch for further transportation to international and domestic markets. In a typical year in Alaska, our fleet purchases about $45 million in fuel, $1.7 million in provisions, and paid over $3.2 million in fishery landing taxes. These cargo offloads in Alaskan ports generate another round of economic activity. Let me click through here. Indirectly supporting or inducing nearly 3,000 maritime support sector jobs in Alaska. These are year-round family wage jobs that include longshore and stevedoring work, cold storage, warehousing, transportation, maintenance, and vessel repairs. Moving on here. All right, here we go. Amendment 80 fisheries are managed by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and National Marine Fisheries Service and are among the best managed fisheries in the world. All of our catch is weighed on computerized flow scales when it comes on board. Each vessel carries a minimum of two federal fishery observers 100% of the time. Observers sample each haul to determine species composition of both target and bycatch species. Raw catch records, catch production records, and bycatch records are reported daily to National Marine Fisheries Service as well as private data monitoring firms, which allow us to assess where we are on the grounds at any given point. Our flatfish and cod fisheries boast sustainability labeling from the Marine Stewardship Council as well as the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute's RFM certification program. It is because of this extraordinary level of management, monitoring, oversight that we have exceptional catch and bycatch accountability. As such, we can confidently attest to both our target catch and bycatch numbers. So despite the fact that halibut live and commingle with our target catch, halibut bycatch accounts for less than 0.5% of our total catch. While halibut is a small fraction of our overall catch, the management of halibut bycatch is as important, if not more important, than the management of our target species. Halibut bycatch takes on this importance because it's a prohibited species with hard cap limits. As we've already discussed, being a prohibited species has a couple of implications. First, halibut are a high-value fish, and there are other fishermen and communities that rely upon this halibut. Under current management by the IPHC, when bycatch users such as the trawl sector reduce their bycatch, that fish can be instead harvested by the directed halibut fleet the following year. Second, because it is a prohibited species, we're required to discard 100% of our halibut bycatch, whether it's dead or alive. And lastly, our fishery has a restrictive hard cap limit set in regulation. This means that if we were to exceed that hard cap, our fishery would be shut down. I'm having a hard time keeping the clicker on the right spot. Amendment 80 companies, captains, and crew work extremely hard to reduce halibut bycatch. I'd like to draw your attention to three key components of these reductions. First, our ability to successfully manage halibut bycatch has been largely due to a cooperative fishery management structure created by the 2008 rationalization program known as the Amendment 80 program. Prior to this program, our fleet fished under a common quota for catch and bycatch. Each vessel would race to harvest as much of that target quota as quickly as possible with minimal regard for bycatch. As a result, our fisheries were routinely shut down because we exceeded our bycatch levels. In contrast, under the Amendment 80 program, catch and bycatch quota are allocated down to the specific vessel level. This means that there is no longer a race for fish. A positive incentive of the individual vessel bycatch allocation is that each vessel is incentivized to catch as little halibut as possible throughout the year so that they can fully harvest their target species. If you blow through your halibut early in the year, it's very likely you may have to tie up early and won't be able to harvest all of your allocated species. Because vessels are no longer in a race for fish, our captains can slow down, behave cooperatively, share information on the grounds, and avoid halibut. And since the beginning of the Amendment 80 program, we have not exceeded our halibut bycatch limits. While management structure is critically important, you cannot avoid halibut all the time. The second line of defense has been modifying our gear to reduce halibut bycatch. Gear can be designed to take into account fishing behavior and physical characteristics of halibut. For example, we know that halibut, especially larger halibut, are strong swimmers than our target species. So our gear is designed so that it can be towed at a slower speed in the water, which allows the halibut to swim clear of the gear. Other gear modifications, work. I'm trying to play a video here. I apologize. It didn't come through. Okay, great. All right, sorry. Apologize. Our gear can be designed to take into account fishing behavior and physical characteristics of halibut. For example, we know that halibut, they're stronger swimmers. The other modifications include excluders. Excluders can be designed to take advantage of the halibut's shape and behavior, so even if a halibut swims into the net, it can still escape. Groundfish Forum members all use modified trawl sweeps and regularly use halibut excluders. We just had a quick conversation about gear there. Our bottom gear, over the course of this evolution of reducing bycatch and reducing our impacts, we've reduced the bottom impacts by 90% since 2010-2011 timeframe because of modifications to our gear. A significant problem with excluders, though, is you can lose up to 30% of your target catch. So excluders are a tool, but is not a tool that's effective all of the time. Okay, so you can try to avoid halibut, you can try to exclude halibut, but what do you do when halibut that ends up in your net despite your best efforts? Under current regulations for Amendment 80 catcher processors, all cod ends must be dumped into live tanks, which are located inside the vessel. Catch sampling and catch composition, including the assessment and discard of halibut, take place after the fish go into these live tanks. Unfortunately, due to the time involved in this process, approximately 85% of the halibut caught are dead before they are discarded. Since 2015, Groundfish Forum member companies have been collaboratively working with National Marine Fisheries Service to demonstrate in a special program called an exemptive fishery permit that if the cod end was dumped on the deck, that the assessment and discard of halibut could take place within a 20-minute time frame after the haul was dumped, and that you can maintain high levels of monitoring and accounting as you discard live halibut from the deck. This practice, known as deck sorting, is very simple in concept, quickly but gently getting the live fish back in the water. However, it takes a tremendous amount of work and coordination within the industry and with National Marine Fisheries Service. This program requires additional monitoring cameras on board, one additional federal observer, and a whole host of practices and protocols that we need to follow to make sure that we're getting the proper accounting. So here's a video of this. What you see here is a arrowtooth flounder haul, and we're arrowtooth and halibut look an awful lot alike. That's not all halibut back there on the deck, but these are the halibut that are going overboard. Each vessel that participates in the deck sorting program has modified their vessel to the specific physical characteristics of the boat so they can safely and gently get the fish overboard. We have an additional observer on board who is taking viability assessments and making sure, measuring the fish and sexing the fish. Here's another another video where the cod end has come on board. They're going to release the fish on the deck. During deck sorting, we'll have several crew members from the factory that will come up and assist the observers in finding halibut as the fish is coming out of the nets, and to make sure that we're gathering as many halibut within that first 20 minutes as we can. We're looking for the largest, most viable fish when we do this, and you'll see these guys, they're really trained. When they see a halibut, they are on it. So all of this activity is going on, and it may not be completely apparent, but reducing halibut bycatch is extremely hard work. It takes training of vessel crews, coordination between companies and vessels, both in the office as well as on the fishing grounds. In 2016, the Amendment 80 sector, using all of our tools available, I'm going to turn down the volume here a little bit now, using all of our tools available, reduced our halibut bycatch by 28% from our previous five-year average. These reductions in halibut bycatch by the Amendment 80 sector have been a major contributor to the directed halibut fishery along the Bering Coast and in the Pribilof Islands. We are proud of these reductions and continue to have substantive interactions and regular meetings with halibut fishermen from that region. And they have been very, very supportive of our efforts and have a good appreciation of the impacts that these kinds of activities have with our sector. But you all, we haven't had these conversations with you all, so I just wanted to make sure that you understand that to do all these activities, the avoidance of halibut on the grounds, gear modifications and deck sorting, that results in lost time on the fishing grounds to us. There's an increase in observer costs because we're carrying two, maybe three or four observers. And there's also a 20% drop in our overall factory production and catch rate. There are trade-offs, as Mr. Merrill said before. To reduce halibut, you have trade-offs, or reduce halibut bycatch, you have trade-offs in the directed fishery. And ultimately, for the state of Alaska, that means fewer port calls from our vessels into port, fewer revenue, less fish coming across the dock. These are all efforts that we fully embrace and are undertaking, but it's important for you to understand that there are trade-offs. Click through here. The last thing I wanted to show you was just overall, and Mr. Merrill showed this to you already, but the overall rate of bycatch throughout the range has dropped by a substantial amount since the full Americanization of the fishery in the 1990s. It's down by over 50%, and the Amendment 80 fleet, particularly in the Bering Sea, has had a large part in these reductions, as the pollock and the catcher vessels have also been a major participant in that. So that is the end of my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions later.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. We appreciate your presentation. And with that, we will take a brief at ease. And next up will be Brent Payne with the United Catcher Boats. And Mr. Payne will be joining us telephonically. Payne?
Yes.
If you would identify yourself and your affiliation for the record, please, and begin your presentation.
Yes, my name is Brent Payne. I'm the executive director of United Catcher Boats, and I'm going to give you a talk about the efforts of the Bering Sea Catcher Vessel Trawl Fleet in minimizing Chinook and Chum salmon bycatch in the pollock fishery. So I guess I'll have Reed flip the pages of my PowerPoint presentation, but I'm on page one, so it's a nice picture of the Russian Orthodox Church for the seawolf. So flipping to page two, I just threw this slide in here to give you an idea of where the pollock fishery occurs. And this is just a picture of the 2016 winter fishery last year. And you can see Kink Cove, Sandpoint, Dutch Harbor, Accutan on the chart there. But the more pink and more purple-colored dots are kind of where the concentration of the pollock fishery occurs. Flipping to page three, and read, there's a page number on the lower right corner.
We got it.
The Bering Sea pollock fishery, this slide just kind of gives you an idea of how the pollock fishery is managed. And we operate under a catch share program, as Mr. Merrill and Mr. Oliver talked about. But the American Fisheries Act was an act passed by Congress in 1998 that rationalized the Bering Sea pollock fishery. And for catcher vessels and shore-based plants and mothership processors, there's 91 shore-based catcher vessels that deliver to six shore-based plants, and they're organized into six cooperatives. And they deliver our pollock to Dutch Harbor, Accutan, Beaver Inlet, Sandpoint, and King Cove communities. And there are 19 mothership-based catcher vessels there at sea, and they deliver to three mothership processors. Flipping on to page four, and talking more specific about salmon now, Mr. Merrill talked about the federal regulations and salmon. We call them, prohibited species catch regulations. And there's regulations now for Chinook and Chum salmon. And for the pollock fishery, prior to 2010, from 1995 to 2010, there wasn't a hard cap on the pollock fishery. Rather, there were regulations that forced the fleet to move to different areas, and we call those triggered closure areas. And that was the tool to reduce Chinook salmon and Chum salmon. But beginning in 2011, the North Pacific Council recommended and the National Marine Fisheries Service implemented a hard cap between the four sectors of the pollock fishery. That we call that Amendment 91. And then Chum salmon was more of a combination of triggered closures. And then in 2017, Chum salmon now is managed alongside with Chinook salmon. And that was the North Pacific Council's Amendment 110. So flipping on to page five, so we used the rationalized pollock fishery with our cooperative structure to govern our bycatch management program. And without that kind of rationalized fishery structure, we would not be able to do this kind of thing. I think that's really a key point to make. All the cooperatives have an intercooperative agreement, that's called an ICA. We kind of live in the world of acronyms, so I'm probably going to get you a little bit confused with my presentation. But so the first acronym here is the ICA, Intercoop Agreement, and that's just a written agreement that all the pollock participants amongst all sectors agree to. And then within an ICA, for example, we have a rolling hotspot agreement. And these first went into effect in the early 2000s. And if you flip to page, if you just go to page 7 and skip over page 6, you'll see a good chart demonstration of a rolling hotspot closure, and this would be a particular every week we have a private data company called SeaState that provides up-to-date data to the fleet, and those big red circles are where the higher rates of bycatch have occurred. And so on a weekly basis, we have agreed through our agreement to close those areas to vessels that have high rates of bycatch. Vessels that have low rates of bycatch can fish in those areas because they've proven that they can keep their bycatch low at an individual vessel level. So if you, in page 8, the other tool we use is a fixed area closure. And if we know that there's a certain area where we fish pollock, it is predominantly going to be an area where we have high rates of bycatch of Chinook or Chum from one year to the next, we'll go ahead and close that right before the season even starts. So And if you go to page 9, you'll see that that box right north of Unimak Island and to the west, that's an area we call the horseshoe. And that box is closed at the very beginning of the pollock hay season to the catcher vessels and the catcher processors. So we're not allowed to fish in there. If you do fish in there, you get penalized, and we assign a fee. So if you go to page 10, here's the really key, and this was made by Mr. Merrill, Mr. Oliver, but we have 100% observer coverage, and so the Chinook salmon counts that we use are not estimates. They are based on actual counts, or they are a census by the observer program. The catcher processor and catcher vessel owners pay a monthly amount to contractors for that coverage. And then they also require our vessels to release all the data to our private database company called SeaState. And that includes catch data, that's observer data, and the ADF&G fish tickets, as well as VMS, or vessel monitoring system data, so we know exactly where the boats are fishing at any given time. So if we go to page 11, so now that we kind of get into some pretty interesting or more creative ideas of what we can do with our cooperatives. And in 2011, the North Pacific Council recommended passage of Amendment 91. And buried in that amendment is this theme of an incentive-based program. So you can either have a carrot or a stick to kind of, you know, encourage people to do things. And our program is very much a carrot-based system. When the hard cap for Chinook salmon was established, the industry said, well, if you give the vessels an opportunity to avoid salmon and to get a reward, you'll get great change in behavior. And so the concept of saving Chinook salmon by incentives was what we agreed to do, and we presented that to the North Pacific Council. And how that works is we have a hard cap, and we get our percentage share of 60,000 Chinook. However, we have an incentive to keep that. If you go to page 13 now, so we get our share of 60,000, but we have an incentive to keep it under 47,591, or our share of that, if we have an incentive plan agreement or an IPA. So if you go to page, you go to page 15, please, to see that the requirements for an incentive plan agreement. It provides incentives at the individual vessel level to minimize Chinook bycatch. Point number two, it incentivizes vessels to avoid Chinook bycatch at all levels of abundance and in all years. And that's really a crucial point. And that was one point that ADF&G really drove home at the North Pacific Council. But, you know, they, as opposed to just a hard cap, you kind of fish up to that level. But it doesn't, you want to try and develop a bycatch avoidance program that have a fleet avoid Chinook or any kind of species at all levels of abundance at all years. And then third, our other requirement is that it rewards vessels that successfully avoid Chinook and then penalizes vessels that fail to avoid Chinook. If you go to page 16, the incentives must influence fishing decisions at levels below the hard cap level, and we have to hold bycatch to a performance standard of less than 47,591 in most years, and that's apportioned by sector. So going to page 17, I'm just going to kind of flip to this because I think I'm taking a little bit more of your time. So for the inshore sector, on page 18, what we have is called the Salmon Savings Incentive Program, and that's the program that we submit to the North Pacific Council every year that shows this is how we're going to manage our Chinook salmon and how we're going to guarantee that we're going to keep our salmon bycatch low. And that, so the way we do it is we allocate to each vessel, I'm going to go to page 19, please, a base cap allocation, or each vessel's share of 47,591. And that's based on the performance standard. Now, page 20, and then base cap allocations are made pro rata to a vessel's pollock allocation. So an average vessel that's fishing shoreside in the Bering Sea might receive somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 Chinook salmon. Some of them only receive maybe 70 or 80 Chinook salmon to the individual vessel. And that's their base cap allocation. they're going to use that to try and stay below that base cap. So that's the incentive. So then if they stay below that amount, they earn salmon savings credits. And then so that's shown on slide 21. If you go to slide 22, the savings credits bridge the gap between the performance standard and the hard cap at the individual vessel level. And I probably lost a few of you, and I apologize, but if you go to page 23. So when a vessel, this is really key. This is the main incentive of our program. When a vessel's annual bycatch cap falls below its base cap, it earns salmon savings credits. And then page 24, so one credit is earned for every three salmon avoided below their base cap allocation. So, and then that's a credit that you can use in future years if you need it. And then you save them in a salmon savings credit account. So if you go to page 25, and then you have this, you have credits, and that can kind of be used for future years. But any unused credits expire after 3 years, so they go away. So the game is to try and save as many credits as you can, kind of for a rainy day. But when you save those credits, you're actually avoiding salmon while you're doing that. So that's the incentive of our program. And if you go to page 27, what this SSIP program really does by creating these savings is it guarantees that we will not catch more than 21,750 Chinook salmon in any year. At page 28, we've already talked about the data that we need to have in order to do this program. And then page 29, I threw this slide in here. One of the things we've been working on for about 10 or 12 years is developing an excluder device that we put into a midwater trawl net that actually can exclude salmon, but yet not exclude pollock. And that's required now by all vessels fishing pollock in the Bering Sea. And then so the last couple slides kind of just show the results of our efforts. This was based on National Fisheries Service report to the North Pacific Council in December. The first page shows, you can kind of see that little chart inside there for the AFA, that's the American Fisheries Act inshore. We took about a little over 10,000 Chinook. Our limit was 33,000, so we were at about 30% of that limit. And you can see the same is true for the other sectors as well, quite a bit under the limit. And then page 31, you can see right when we started really working on trigger closures and the incentive-based plan agreement that we lowered our Chinook bycatch significantly. I think Mr. Cotton referred to that year, 2007. You see that big spike. That was without any of these measures in place. And then so last slide is a picture of a boat owned by a Hall family in Kodiak. Chairman Stute. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Payne. We appreciate it. We'll take a brief at ease. Processors, if you'd state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Mattson. Excuse me. I'm executive director of the At Sea Processors Association. I live here in Juneau and been in Alaska for 40-plus years. Madam Chair, I'm pleased to be here today to report about what the At Sea Processors have been doing to reduce our bycatch. Just a real quick look, a little bit about who we are, a little bit about the brief overview that probably you've already had on regulatory requirements, and then exactly what we've been trying to do to avoid it. And I'm going to touch on each one of those areas where we believe that we've been making progress on reducing our Chinook bycatch. First, who we are. As you can see, we're large vessels. We do catch and process on board. We are only in the federal fisheries. We do not fish in state waters, so we're not involved in the parallel fishery. You see the Pollock Conservation Cooperative up there? That's just a name for our cooperative. As you've heard from Mr. Payne and Mr. Woodley, we are privileged in the Bering Sea to have a cooperative structure that allows us to more rationally manage our target fishery and bycatch. I put some of these vessels up here, Madam Chairman, because our fleet is partnered and owned by several of the CDQ groups. The vessel right here, the one on the left, is Glacier Fish Company, and they are owned 50% owned by Norton Sound CDQ, a program. The vessel on the upper right is Coastal Villages, and it's 100% owned by that CDQ group and is a member of ours. The one on the lower right is American Seafoods, and they have ownership, Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association has ownership in there, as well as Bristol Bay BBEDC owns part of one of our other vessels. So we are partners with many of the CDQ groups. A little bit about pollock. You know, we appreciate if you eat it right now. It's Lent, and fish is good, so you'll see some ads from McDonald's about the sustainable pollock fishery. Also, you probably heard on the report this morning on Laney Welch's Fish Factor that we've been able to crack the nut a little bit on the school food lunch program. So we're excited about those markets. But it is a cousin to cod. It's a white flaky. We are the largest fishery in the United States, as you've heard, and we are the largest certified sustainably fishery in the world. And you can see that we're both certified by ASME's program and MSC. You've heard that many of the federal fisheries in the Bering Sea carry two federal observers on each vessel. We have flow scales, and we also have lots of cameras. We are a product of the American Fisheries Act, which allowed the structure of the co-ops, as well as, Madam Chairman, requires us a great deal of transparency. Any of the information that I provide you or that Glenn Merrill provides you or the state provides you on our catch, both target and any of the additional species, is available to anyone on the website. We need to report everything that every vessel catches, and we have to report that by the vessel. So that is all available, and it was available right away after the implementation of the American Fisheries Act. So we're very transparent in the accountability. Madam Chair, you've heard about the two regulatory packages that take us to today, Amendment 91 and then recently Amendment 110, that provides us objectives. And I guess I'm going to spend a little time talking about the unique program in the Bering Sea for Chinook salmon. As you heard from Mr. Payne and others, we have had time and area closures for Chinook salmon. We didn't have a hard cap, but if you exceeded a certain threshold, you had to move out of that area. What we realized was that Chinook don't really pay attention to those boundaries sometimes, and we actually experienced that we were excluded from areas, and we actually caught more salmon outside those areas than if we would have been allowed to stay in them. So it became quickly apparent that regulatory closures weren't really doing justice to the species we were trying to avoid. So the council came up with a pretty unique program that you've heard a little bit about that gives us objectives. They identified objectives that they wanted us to meet, and you've heard some of the language about it has to be at the vessel level. It has to be those provisions have to reduce bycatch in any level of Chinook salmon or pollock abundance. And there needed to be but they left it up to us to design that. For example, my fleet, catcher processor fleet, the most important thing to my fleet is to be able to stay on the fish. If we have to pick up the net and move and clean the factory, we are losing time. We lose access to the good quality fish. So what we really want to do is to be good performers so that we can stay in areas of low bycatch. Here's just a slide to remind you that, you know, we do have hard caps. The hard caps are backdrops. It's expected that we will never reach those, especially the absolute cap. Will shut us down. The performance standard cap that Mr. Payne talked about is what we really try to manage to. If we exceed that cap 3 out of 7 years, it becomes our hard cap. And you can see that's a big difference. And so we would avoid that at all costs. And then now in 2017, if the Department of Fish and Game determines that we're in a low abundance year based on their Three River Index, our caps also are reduced, both the absolute cap and the performance standard cap. IPA, another acronym. I guess I'm not going to read this slide. I think you have copies of it. But again, this is a unique nature. We submit an incentive plan agreement, which is a contract among my members about how we're going to reduce bycatch. They agree to it. We submit it for approval to NIMS. They have the final approval whether our program meets their objectives. It did, and we've been operating under this IPA since 2011. We have modified it. We've modified it in anticipation of Amendment 111 or 110. So we do now require salmon excluders to be used by the vessels during certain periods of high Chinook abundance on the grounds. We also have an outlier provision, which I'm going to show you some information from, because ultimately, Madam Chair, what we're trying to do is change behavior. I think that the council understood that a hard cap doesn't provide you incentive to stay below that hard cap. You can get right up to the 59,999 and still have no consequences. But the goal is to reduce bycatch at any level of Chinook and pollock. And this unique program allows that, and our structure also allows that. So here's the primary components of our incentive plan. Ours isn't quite as complicated as the inshore just because of our operational needs. Data gathering, monitoring, reporting information is critical. Technology has helped with that. I'm going to show you a picture of alerts that we get and the fleet gets. We do share the information from the alerts with a third party that then reports back to us about where the high Chinook areas are. We, as an association, provide co-op reports twice a week to our fleet, and it gives them a red light, green light, yellow light performance about how they're doing overall. And then they get a technical report from C-State that talks about our Chinook program. We've identified the bycatch avoidance areas. Those areas are prohibited from vessels that have our poor bycatch performance. I heard a little bit about the closed area that we have had forever that's always closed during A season. Then we have conditional B season closures. I mentioned the vessel outlier provisions and then gear research. I think the other great component of this is accountability. We have to come back every year to the council and try to demonstrate as well as we can that the mechanisms in our IPA are working. Madam Chairman, this one is just a little bit of technology. So I have an alert set up on my system that if any of my vessels catch more than 10 Chinook salmon, I get an alert. I'm not the only one that gets an alert. All the fleet gets an alert, and they can click on these lines and find out where that vessel encountered the Chinook salmon. Communication is key. No longer are you allowed to go to Stephanie's hotspot and not share that information. Everybody knows where you are, and it's a necessary component. I mentioned the other reports. I think it's important to recognize that as well as sophisticated as our vessels are with technology, the captains cannot see if we have Chinook salmon in the net until the net comes on board. You can't determine that from the technology. Here's one of the examples that we provide to the council that demonstrates where our closures are. These are the 2015 avoidance areas that were identified. The weeks below are those vessels that were excluded from that area during that week. So you can see February 26th of 2015, we had seven vessels that were poor performers compared to the rates, and they were excluded from that area that was identified that week. And so they had to move and suffer the consequences of moving. Here's the two areas. The top level is the Chinook saving or the Chinook conservation area that Mr. Payne spoke about. That area has been known as a high Chinook area in the A season. And so we start out the season with that closed. It's about 725 square feet or miles, I'm sorry. The lower panel is those B season conservation areas that has a formula, and if that formula in September is exceeded, then those areas also get shut down to everyone. This is new in our report. We're trying to figure out a way to convey to the council about our outlier provision. So our outlier provision is that if there is a vessel that is more than 1.5 standard deviation from the rest, that vessel is considered an outlier. If it's an outlier for three consecutive seasons, remember we have two seasons per year, there are additional penalties for that vessel. That vessel is excluded from any area that's been identified as a high bycatch area, regardless of its performance, and it's also excluded from those B season conditional closures, regardless, again, of its performance. We've not had an outlier. We've been able to change behavior. so that we haven't had it yet, but we'll see. We continue to report on that. Additionally, you've heard a little bit about salmon excluders. We continue to work on salmon excluders. It's not a technology that you can go to the store and buy. We continue to look at fish behavior. For example, we know that the Chinook are stronger swimmers than pollock, and so the pollock fall back into the cod end. The Chinook stay forward, and so we kind of have the panels where they can escape. We're also experimenting with lights. We understand that that the salmon may be attracted to light, and if there's a way for us to attract the salmon to go to the holes, that'd be better. Now, granted, this is never going to allow us to fish in an area of high salmon bycatch. It's just going to be another tool that we have to try to minimize our bycatch. You've heard a little bit about the genetics. This is a benefit of kind of a slowed down, rationalized program. We've been collecting genetics work, or the agency has, for some time, but now every 10th Chinook salmon is tested for genetics. And you can see the history. It's kind of hard to read, but it goes back to 2008. You can see that in almost all of the Alaska stream, terminal streams, the presence of those salmon in our bycatch has decreased. Coastwide, it's 40%. Mid-Yukon is lower than it has been, and upper Yukon as well. What has increased is the West Coast U.S. fishery and British Columbia Chinook salmon in our bycatch. This is helpful to us. What we're hoping, Madam Chairman, is that the more we get this, if we can identify areas in the Bering Sea where Western Alaska Chinook like to hang out, we could modify our programs to try to address that. Unfortunately, Chinook salmon like to eat baby pollock, so they are quite commingled. Food bank programs. You've heard about the food bank. Our vessels participate in the food bank program for salmon. You know, every salmon is counted by an observer. If that salmon is food quality and meets the standards of the food bank program, it goes into the food bank program. And it has since come back, even though the Sea Share is located in Seattle. There has been funds that have gotten that back to Alaska communities and the food bank programs here. In addition to Beans Cafe, we also do Glory Hole. We'll be doing Glory Hole, serving the homeless there in June. So we do try to make sure that we are good stewards. In summary, Madam Chairman, the CPIPA is composed of three incentive measures. We have the hard cap. It's at the vessel level. We have rolling hotspot closure avoidance areas, and we have seasonal closures. Our challenge is to provide evidence that these measures are working. It's not always in the number. You know, you kind of look at rates. So are we able to demonstrate that behaviors changed and vessels are moving? We believe that we've come up with a few metrics that have demonstrated that. So we can continue to show movement of vessels to avoid those higher risk areas. We have had better bycatch performance, especially in our rates, and we continue to spend money and the federal dollars, if we're successful in those grants, to continue to develop our salmon excluders. Madam Chairman, I didn't talk about halibut. The pelagic trawl, which is a pollock fishery, has not a lot of encounters with halibut. We do have a guideline, though, that we are to stay under. We have learned that that's a lot of temperature dependent about where those halibut are when there's a cold pool in the Bering Sea. So I didn't address that. We primarily are a pollock organization and catch about 99.9% pollock. So I appreciate your attention this morning. I know that's a lot of information listed up here as the companies that are comprised of the at-sea processors.
Thank you, Ms. Madsen. We certainly appreciate you coming and sharing your wealth of knowledge as have the other presenters, and we will take a brief of these.
Madam Chairman, just one thing. I think Reed might have passed these out. These are just posters that summarize all that, so you kind of have a little – you didn't, but you're going to.
We will make sure our committee members
It's just a good overview and provides just a little
Thank
bit more.
Thank you. And our next presenter will be Julie Bonney from the Alaska Groundfish Data Bank, and she will be presenting telephonically. We'll take a brief at ease in the meantime. On record, and we will have Julie Bonney. Ms. Bonney, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear. If you'd state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Yes. My name is Julie Bonney, and I represent the members of Alaska Groutfish Data Bank. It's an organization that's centered in Kodiak, and it's both trawlers out of Kodiak and processors as well. So the next slide after the introduction slide. So the Kodiak fishing fleet consists of about 38 to 40 vessels, mostly are in the 80-foot range, so they're much smaller than the ones that you have, the trawlers in the Bering Sea. Many are family-owned, and many employ locally based crews in Kodiak. Most of the fleet has cooperative fishing experience through the AFA, the Bering Sea Pollock Program, West Coast Whiting, and then we also have a small rationalization program in the Gulf called the Central Gulf Rockfish Program. The fleet delivers to six Kodiak shoreside processors, comprising about 60% of the total Kodiak port landings in terms of volume. Next slide. Our trawl fisheries are sustainable and well-managed. We're unique in terms of the presentations that you heard before because we do both pollock and then bottom fishing, too. So we deliver pollock, cod, rockfish, and flatfish. They're all federally managed species and regulated through the North Pacific Management Council. Pollock and cod and flatfish carry the eco labels like Ms. Mattson suggested, the MSC and RFM certificates. They're high volume, low value fisheries that narrowly operate year round. Next slide. We have a significant economic impact to the community of Kodiak. The Port of Kodiak is number three in the nation by value and number two by volume. Groundfish harvesting and processing accounts for almost 20% of all employment in Kodiak. Groundfish fishing and processing accounts for more jobs, more income, and more impact on the Kodiak economy than any other fishery. 2,000 Kodiak jobs, $111 million in labor income, $187 million in total seafood output. Year-round fisheries create year-round resident jobs. About 50% of the processor workers are year-round Kodiak residents, 1,390 people. Kodiak has more year-round fisheries than any other community in Alaska, more shoreside processors, and employs the highest percentage of local residents of any major production region in the entire state. And this information is based on an economic impact study that was commissioned by the city and the borough of Kodiak, done by the McDowell Group. Next slide, please. I think it's important that people understand the difference between the different management structures in the North Pacific because it affects the ability to manage bycatch and achieve total allowable catch. In the Gulf trawl fisheries, the fishing vessels race against each other for access to the target fish, that's pollock, cod, and flatfishes as well, while subject to constraining fleet-wide bycatch caps, halibut and chinook. No individual vessel accountability for bycatch and no incentives to slow the fishery and work together. While in the Bering Sea, which you've just heard about from the three different groups, is that both target species and bycatch are annually allocated to co-ops, so no one is racing for catch. Co-ops have formal agreements and penalties to control behavior and include incentives for all participants to collaborate to minimize bycatch. Next slide, bycatch restrictions. Even though we don't have the same tools, there are bycatch limits for both Chinook salmon and halibut, as you've been heard from both Glenn Merrill and Chris Oliver, in the Gulf trawl fisheries. If these limits are reached, the fisheries close for all participants, not just an individual participant, because they're fleet-wide caps. These closures can be either seasonally or they can be for the entire year. Another way to kind of look at some of the regulations and amendment packages is kind of the timeline. So first was the Chinook salmon bycatch limits that were imposed on the pollock fishery, and that occurred in 2012. And then we also had another amendment package that imposed the Chinook salmon bycatch limit for all the non-pollock fisheries, which it was imposed in 2015, along with reductions of the halibut bycatch limits of 15%, which was implemented over a three-year period from 2014 to 16. What have the trawl efforts been to tackle bycatch? The first one is we advocated for the Central Gulf Rockfish Co-op Management Program. It became effective in 2007 and it sunsets in 2021. This program was designed within the North Pacific Management Council process to meet multiple objectives, including minimizing bycatch, fishery stability, and increasing community benefits. We've also advocated for a similar program at the North Pacific Management Council with bycatch objectives for the trawl, cod, pollock, and flatfish fisheries. These efforts started in 2012 and died in 2016. This is what has happened within the rockfish program, the results. And as you can see that under the Race for Fish that was in the late 1990s to the mid-2000s, we were catching about 60 pounds of halibut per metric ton of rockfish. Now we are taking less than 10, so we've had a six-fold decrease in halibut bycatch under that cooperative program. Other efforts is we've done several excluder designs. This one was done out at one of the local net shops. It's just a halibut excluder for the cod target fishery, and this excluder uses fish morphology to separate catches. As you can see, you have narrow slots along the sides, which allow the flatfish and halibut to escape, but then the round fish, cod, can't get out because they can't fit through the slots. So the experimental fishing permit that we developed this excluder showed a 57% reduction of halibut bycatch. These excluders are now widely used in the Gulf and the Bering Sea trawl cod fisheries. We've also developed, now I'm on the next slide, for salmon excluders. We did a EFP in the Gulf with two of the Kodiak boats over four seasons in 2013 and 2014, and we was successful reducing, seeing a salmon escapement of 33 to 54%. Another effort that we've done for bycatch is we purchased two loaner video systems that we, the fleet can come and borrow and then put them in their nest to see how to record the excluder shape and also fish behavior in the net. These are two examples of some of the video. One is showing looking at using lights in the net to see if you can attract salmon or whatever you're trying to exclude to get them to go out. The other is a test of a salmon excluder that was designed for the cod flatfish fishery. Next slide. The Kodiak trawlers, another effort is a voluntary co-op management and voluntary hotspot reporting and alerts for the pollock fishery. This is specific in terms of Chinook salmon for pollock. The voluntary efforts are to replicate what you see in the Bering Sea fleets, which they have in regulation. It's an ad hoc process to allocate both pollock and Chinook salmon to participating vessels to stop the race for fish. These allocations are aggregated at the processor level to create co-ops. Voluntary agreements include bycatch reporting requirements and individual vessel performance standards. This requires multiple fleet meetings and can be extremely contentious and time-consuming. It requires 100% consensus by fishery participants and is not always achieved since it may be in a vessel's best interest to race for higher catches even though the fishery may close earlier due to a bycatch. These agreements are tenuous and uncertain as a long-term fishery management structure and do not cover all the ground fisheries that the fleet participates in. Next slide, consequences of fishery closures due to bycatch. We have several examples. In 2015, the cod and flatfish fisheries closed May 3rd due to the newly imposed Chinook salmon cap for the non-pollock fisheries. Through an emergency rule that was promulgated through the council, we were able to reopen the fishery August 10th. The potential foregone revenue that was projected through the EA through this emergency rule suggested that it would have been a $4.6 million ex-vessel loss and an $11.3 million first wholesale value. In 2016, we had similar problems in terms of the fleet-wide halibut cap in terms of the arrowtooth fisheries. They were closed for 120 days, which was basically a third of the fishing year. We're seeing a lot of promise in the marketplace for this particular species, but because industry can't produce the supply, it's too unpredictable because of the bycatch restriction. It's really making it a rough go. Next slide. In 2017, we've similar crises going on in the fisheries. Right now, we've taken 47% of the Chinook limit for the Central Gulf pollock fisheries, and only 32% of the Central Gulf pollock quota has been caught. There are three pollock seasons remaining to be harvested, and when the cap is hit, the fishery is closed for the year. We are in our Gulf cod and flatfish Chinook bycatch cap. We've had 55% of the Chinook limit has been taken so far, and this has been through the Western Gulf cod fishery. It's a different fleet. They operate out of Sandpoint and King Cove. Well, that leaves 45% of our Chinook limit, which is designed to support the Central Gulf trawl fleet for their needs for Pacific cod for the whole year and also our year-round flatfish fisheries. We'll see what happens. Early closures means the trawl fisheries do not meet total allowable catches, resulting in impacts to harvesters, processors, coastal communities, and the state of Alaska in terms of foreground tax revenue. Next slide. The limited access system, Race for Fish, fails to reward conscientious fishermen and favors the fishermen that catch the most amount of fish in the shortest amount of time, regardless of bycatch performance. There's a lot of frustration that exists within the Kodiak, the fleet dependent on Gulf trawl fisheries, all of who have experienced the benefits of cooperative management in the Bering Sea trawl fisheries and the Central Gulf rockfish program. The fleet calls it co-op envy. Participants continue to do the best they can based on the cards that they have been dealt, and at this point we believe it is a solvable problem. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Bonney, and we appreciate it. And we will take a brief at ease in preparation for our last presenter, Linda Benkin, Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. Ms. Benkin, are you available?
I am. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just great. If you'd identify yourself and your affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Yes, this is Linda Benkin. I'm Executive Director of Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. And if I could ask Reed to advance to the second slide and just give you a little background. Our organization was founded in 1978 and foreign fishing, promote local small boat fisheries. And despite our name, our members longline for halibut and sable fish, but we also have members who troll, seine, and gillnet for salmon, some that crab, shrimp on the off season, so very diverse set of fisheries that they participate. And our organization does participate in fishery management at multiple levels. And going to the next slide, we promote sustainable fisheries and thriving small boat community-based fishing communities through policy advocacy, collaborative research, which is what I will mostly talk about today, and the Young Fishermen's Initiative. And again, even though our name says fishermen, we include fishermen and fisherwomen in our membership. Going to the next slide, focusing on collaborative research. In 2009, Alpha launched a fishery conservation network, our thinking being that if we brought together fishermen to work towards goals, or fishermen and scientists, we could involve fishermen in ways to solve the conservation issues or challenges that they identified. Going to the next slide, we find fishermen to be great problem solvers, and by combining their problem-solving ability with the rigors of science, have been able to identify solutions to a number of complex problems that we would not have been able to come up with on our own. The other part of what we do with our fishery conservation network is help make small boat fishermen competitive in a world that's very technologically advanced, as I think you've seen from the previous presentations, and keep these small boats that are so important to the communities viable and competitive. Going to the next slide, we have a number of fishery conservation network projects. Rockfish reporting and bathymetric mapping are the two I will focus on today. But we've also worked with the North Pacific Council to develop electronic monitoring for our fleet to improve fuel efficiency and also to address issues of marine mammal depredation on longline gear. Focusing now on the next slide on rockfish bycatch. So our fisheries do target halibut and sablefish. We don't have bycatch issues of those fisheries per se because those are our targets. But in our fisheries, we do take a bycatch of rockfish. Rockfish are very long-lived. They are slow to reproduce if overfished. They're can take a while to rebuild. And we've seen triggers to other target fisheries or closures of other target fisheries triggered off the West Coast. British Columbia is actually right now facing some potential restrictions on their halibut fishery imposed by rockfish, low quotas for certain rockfish species. So our fleet proactively decided that we would look for ways to develop tools for our fishermen to control rockfish bycatch in their fisheries. So we are allowed a bycatch of 10% of rockfish against the halibut on board, 15% against the sablefish on board. Provided our fishermen stay under those limits, rockfish is a valuable component of a multi-species fisheries, and there is an overfishing issue. But if we go over allowable biological catches or over those directive fishing standards, we could compromise the health of the rockfish stock. So we started this network. Moving to the next slide, we asked our fishermen to provide us with this data, their bycatch rate, and their catch rate for their target fishery by set quadrant. We verified that data with fish ticket information that they provided. They also provided the location, the start and end point, and the depth of their set. We took that data and we compiled it. Going to the next slide, this slide shows the extent of the coverage we received in just the first few years of collecting this data. And we used that to map where bycatch hotspots were in our target fishery. We then provided, going to the next slide, back to fishermen, maps that showed where we had in 2 out of 3 years and then ongoing hotspots where bycatch rates exceeded the rates that were set by fisheries managers. And we provided back to each fisherman participating in the network a map, a chart that looks like the one on the right that you're looking at there, that included their sets, laid over the bathymetry, which I'll talk about more in a minute, color-coding those set quadrants to show what their bycatch rates were, if they were an acceptable level or it exceeded our target for allowance of their bycatch rates. Going to the next slide. We also worked with our fishermen to map habitat and to provide them with a kind of view of the seafloor structure that bigger boats have with a sort of much more sophisticated technology than many of our small boats can afford. If you look at the chart on the left-hand side, that's a typical NOAA chart that you can either buy a paper copy of or have on a computer on board these days. It just includes soundings at regular interviews of depth. It's difficult looking at that for someone to picture what the benthic habitat really is. So that those two charts both show the same place. That's Bjork Island off of Sitka. The bathymetric charts that we've been able to develop to work with for our fleet look more like the one on the right in areas that have been mapped with multi-beam side scan sonar. So if you picture a set running along the bumpy kind of habitat, that's areas that are hard bottom, host corals, sponges, sensitive habitat that are also home to rockfish, particularly juvenile rockfish. If a vessel knows right where those reefs are, sets near them but not over them, catch rates of halibut would be strong, but rockfish bycatch can be limited. So these tools in combination with the logbook data allow people to be very specific about how they set their year and through that to control their bycatch. I guess I'm going to run out of time here, so I'll try and speed up. Going to the next slide, that shows the extent of coverage we've got from our bathymetric mapping. We collect data from each of our boats who are mapping data as they're fishing, and by combining that, provide them with a much more data-rich environment than they would have working individually. To give you a little bit more perspective on how the bathymetric mapping works, again, here is a NOAA chart. If you go to read, it's number 13 that shows just a white chart. Moving to the next slide, that shows what the bathymetric mapping contours would look like when a vessel purchases the software that we're using initially, and then on the next slide, what that same spot looks like once vessels have run over it, collected data, shared that data with us, we've been able to compile it and give them back a much more in-depth look of at that those contours, the gullies that are where you find your best fishing and how to fish that area in the most effective ways. One more look at that again. On the right-hand side is the standard chart as it's purchased with NobleTech mapping software, and then again on the left, what we've been able to provide back to the fleet after compiling data from multiple boats. So using their bycatch information, overlaying their sets over this kind of in-depth look at the habitat, it's much more, fishermen are much more able to set their gear in ways that maximize their efficiency in catching their target, but controlling their bycatch rates for rockfish. So with this combination of mapping and both the rockfish bycatch and the habitat, our members working in this network were able to reduce their bycatch of rockfish in the halibut fishery by 20% and 6% in the sablefish fishery. We now focus them on staying under directed fishing standards rather than achieving additional reductions, since the rockfish they catch is valuable and we're not facing any problems with our rockfish stock at this time. But again, our goal was for them to have the tools that if we ever do face a problem with rockfish management, that they have those tools to address that. And I'm sorry, I'm on slide 17 now, Reed. And wrapping it up, just in time, I think, that's the work that our fleet's been doing to address the bycatch issues that we see as a particularly relevant to our fisheries, and it's one of the projects that our Fishery Conservation Network has tackled.
Well, we certainly thank you for your presentation, as we do all the presenters today. And I would like to say to the committee, if anyone has any questions, if you would get your questions to my office, we'll get them to the appropriate presenter and get a response and get them back, the information back to the committee members, and make it available here to anyone that would be interested as well. So I really, again, want to thank all the presenters. You did a wonderful job in helping inform this committee as to an important issue as the bycatch. And being there is no further business to come before this committee, we actually made it. I will close this committee at 12 o'clock.